morning. We welcome you to court this new year, and especially welcome Hamilton High School students. Would the Hamilton High School students please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. Students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. This is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students across the state to join us for an oral argument. If the students decide to come, they are given material about the case. They may engage in activities relating to the case. Come to oral argument, and after the second oral argument, have the opportunity to meet with a justice to discuss the procedures for hearing the case, not the substantive issues in the case. And the justice assigned today to meet with the groups, the court with class groups, is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, but it's my understanding that the groups will not be able to stay for that session. Well, you're missing a great event. But
I'm
delighted.
Missing a great event.
And the justice says she is missing a great event of talking with you, but we're delighted you could attend. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. To her left is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, 12AP183, Randy Betts versus Diamond Jim's Auto Sale. Let me read down how this has been programmed. 25 minutes to Lawrence Draper. Who is going to represent Diamond Jim's Auto Sales. Then, Susan, is it Grzokowski? Who represents Randy Betts. And 15 minutes to attorney Timothy J. Aiken, who represents Randy Betts, too. And then 5 minutes to Mr. Drapo. Correct? Okay. With that schedule in mind, Mr. Draper, you may proceed.
We should probably just briefly note Justice Rogensack is not participating in this
case. Oh, I'm sorry. I do this. Thank you, Justice Gableman. I do this by rote. The empty chair is where Justice Rogensack would sit.
Good morning, Chief Justice Abrahamson.
Could you move that microphone closer, please? Thank you.
Fellow Justices, my name is Lawrence Draybot, and I represent Diamond Jim's Auto Sales. I'll start off by saying that although I've been present in this court on a few occasions, this is my first privilege to present argument to you, and I welcome that opportunity. We're here today to ask you to uphold the trial court's decision that gave validity to a settlement agreement reached between two parties to a piece of litigation involving a claim for misrepresentation and an advertising injury claim arising out of the sale of a used automobile. After the lawsuit was initiated, the parties, without assistance of counsel, decided to settle the claim on their
own. Counsel, it seems to me that what you're doing is you're going to walk us into the shallow pool or the shallow part of the pool in regard to the policy argument between right to contract and the public policy behind fee-shifting statutes. And that's what the courts, that's what the trial court focused on, that's what the Court of Appeals focused on, that's what the parties have focused on. I am curious as to why the validity of the purported assignment within the contract has just been accepted as a matter of fact by all parties.
Well, I don't think the assignment has been accepted as a matter of fact. We have raised in our briefs that we do not think that there is a valid assignment, nor do we think that an agreement entered into between Mr. Betts and his attorneys has anything.
I want to stick with the assignment. What standard do you believe this court ought to apply to determining whether such an assignment is valid?
A contract standard, Your Honor. You look at whether it is a clear and unambiguous agreement between the parties.
And which part do you believe that this does not conform with, the contract to employ the law offices of Vince Magna, clear or ambiguous?
I believe it's ambiguous.
Why?
Well, first of all, and the law is clear on this, it has to be construed against the drafter, in this case the attorneys who are representing Mr. Betts.
The record demonstrates that it seems like something that would be presented to a potential client, but the record does reflect a question that it was drafted by the Magna Law Office and presented to Mr. Betts.
I believe the record does demonstrate that that was the retainer agreement between them.
Okay. Well, yeah, there doesn't seem, that wasn't my question. Yes, it's the agreement between them. I assume that it was drafted by the law firm, but I don't know that as a matter of fact.
Well, correct. I don't either.
Great.
I would assume, I guess we should never assume, that the client did not draft it and present it to an attorney. But
it would be out of the ordinary, but so are a lot of things about this case.
Sure. Well, and you asked why it's ambiguous. I think if you look at the first two sections of the agreement, the first sentence under where it says the undersigned Randy Betts hereby employs the law offices of Vince Magna for the purpose of representing in the following case, and that says Diamond Jim Auto Sales. And then it says, I understand that I do not have to pay any attorney's fees unless my attorney recovers money in this case. So the first sentence is, I understand. I understand that I don't have to pay fees unless there is a recovery. It doesn't say, I understand that Mr. Magna gets fees if there's a recovery. It doesn't say, I assign my right to fees to Mr. Magna. And then you look at the next paragraph where it talks about fee shifting. And fee shifting does not in and of itself have this, it's not a magical concept that changes the ownership of the cause of action. And the cause of action allows for fees, and that allowance for fees is owned by the claimant, by the plaintiff in this case. It's not owned by the attorney. Paragraph where it discusses fee shifting says defendant's usually responsible for the fees, and then it goes on and it says, I understand that law offices of Vince Magna is accepting my case with the agreement that it will look to the defendant for payment of the fees. That just indicates where Magna is going to get fees from the defendant out of the case. It doesn't say, I, Randy Betts, am giving up my right to fees. It doesn't say, I assign my right to fees.
Do you think there have to be particular words or phrases?
Pardon me?
Do you think there has to be particular words or phrases in order to constitute a valid assignment?
I do. And cited in the briefs, the Zeisler case discusses that, and even in the Gorton case, it says that you have to use precise words. It has to be a valid, you have to convey exactly the meaning of what you intend, and you construe that against the drafter.
What precise words do you believe are missing from this contract?
Assignment, ownership, and there's a case that we had cited, Riegelman, that discusses what they couch it in terms of there was a lien, an attorney or a doctor's lien or a chiropractor's lien in a case, and that included language as to what constituted a valid assignment. And in that case, they said the attorney can gather records and pursue the case. Well, let me look at the exact language. It says, I hereby authorize the doctor to furnish you, my attorney, with a full report. And then it continues, and it says, I give you a lien to said doctor, and on any settlement, judgment, or verdict as a result of the accident, and I authorize and direct you, my attorney, to pay the doctor the sums that are due and owing, and to withhold sums out of any settlement or judgment as directed as may be necessary to protect the doctor.
What's
First
that
of all,
case?
I agree. Excuse me for 1 second, and I'll be done. And this is as much for your opposing counsel as for you, who I expect will address this when it is her turn. I agree that so far the closest I can find to the requirement, the closest that our chambers can find, is that it be unambiguous language of the assignment, clear and unequivocal. Did the second to last paragraphs of the contract on the second page, under the heading costs and expenses, if we start with the third paragraph from the bottom, I understand that if I do not accept a settlement that my attorneys deem reasonable and my case continues without settlement, I will be required to immediately reimburse the law offices of Vince Magna for all costs and expenses, et cetera, et cetera. And then the next one, I understand that my attorney has the right to terminate me as a client. Did anything about those provisions that raise the issue of an illusory contract, if one party has the ability to simply terminate the contract at any time?
It wasn't addressed in the briefs as to whether it was illusory, but we did address in the briefs those issues, because when you look to clarity ambiguity or whether it was unambiguous, there are several provisions in this retainer agreement that do seem to conflict with one another, and those items that you just pointed out certainly reflect that. And if you look at the...
Any other provisions you think are in conflict?
Well, if you look at the very last regarding...
I've looked at it, but I'm asking you. Yes. Please proceed.
Yeah. The last paragraph says, I, being Mr. Betts, has a right to terminate my attorneys. And then it says, I will be responsible for costs and fees at the termination not to exceed 33 and a third of any gross recovery. So, yes, on one hand, actually the very first paragraph, it says, I understand that I have to pay attorney's fees. Then it changes it a little bit, although not with clarity. And then in further provisions, there are indications that Mr. Betts himself is responsible for the fees. Termination provisions, one of them. Costs and expenses, another. And then the other one pertaining to punitive damages, where it doesn't say anything about an assignment. But it says if there are punitive damages, that I agree, I being Mr. Betts, to pay the losses of Vince Magna 40% of any recovery. So certainly there are provisions in there that I don't know if I have used the term illusory, but certainly which go to the evidence that this is there's ambiguity and there's not a valid assignment.
Okay, thank you.
What did the Mr. Magna sue you for? What was his claim against your client?
Misrepresentation and advertising injury.
No, no. I asked you what Mr. Magna's claim against Diamond Jim's is...
Mr. Megna has no claim against Diamond Jim.
No, doesn't he claim termination of interference with his contract? Doesn't he claim damages from you? Doesn't he want you to pay the attorney fees?
Well, that is what he is trying to advance.
Okay. How much does he want from you?
Several tens of thousands of dollars.
How is that calculated?
Based upon he had submitted the trial court did not address it, but he had submitted a time expense report.
Is that in the record, even though not addressed?
It honestly, it might be in the trial record, but the trial court did not address that because it determined that there was a valid agreement between the parties that included fees.
Sometimes it's important to know what is or is not in the record, and of course I can go through the record, but I'm just wondering, do you know, is it in the record?
I do not know, Your Honor.
Well, it's the appellant's job to bring up the record. And as I understand this case, although I found it interesting that the Aiken firm is representing Betts, it's Mr. Megna whose claim is against you at this hearing. Is that right?
It is Mr. Megna who is seeking fees from my client.
That's right. He is the one that's seeking fees. Betts and you have reached an agreement, and you're happy with the agreement?
It was signed, sealed, and delivered.
And Betts is not debating that, or at least we'll wait and hear from that, but that isn't what the fight's about.
The record reflects no debate from Mr. Betts.
Pardon me?
The record reflects no debate from Mr. Betts.
Okay, so the fight really is Mr. Megna against you.
Correct.
That's what the fight's about. And it's that you interfered with his contract.
Well, there is no interference claim that the trial court addressed.
Okay.
He is seeking fees under the fee-shifting statute.
Right. What other claims are there against you that Mr. Megna is fighting about? What's the claim? Is that the claim here?
The claim is that under the fee-shifting statute, Diamond Jim's Auto Sales owes Mr. Megna his fees.
Okay. And that you settling under these circumstances was an interference in his contract. In effect?
Well, he attempted to advance that in the trial court, and the trial court did not allow him. The trial court looked at the settlement agreement to determine whether all of the claims were resolved.
Okay.
What happened to the Cadillac?
It was returned to Diamond Jim's.
And what did Mr. Betts get in return?
Mr. Betts received the settlement check of $15,000, as he agreed.
Okay, and so if you don't win this case, how does that play out?
I'm sorry?
If you don't win this case, what happens to that $15,000?
The appellate court said the parties are at square one. Return the car, return the money, start from square one. Because the appellate court indicated that the settlement agreement was void because it determined that the attorney had to consent to the settlement based upon public policy, not based upon statute or anything else or any case law. It said based upon public policy, Mr. Megna had to consent to the settlement, and because apparently that had not been done, the settlement agreement was voided, and the parties go back to the beginning.
No one had asked for that relief in the Court of Appeals. Isn't that right?
We asked to enforce the agreement. The trial court did not address any other arguments, such as rescission of the contract, saying it had determined everything based upon the validity of the settlement agreement between the parties.
I think you read, counsel, the part of the agreement. I understand that I have the right to terminate my attorneys. However, if I do so, I will be responsible for the law offices of Vince Magna fees and costs due on the date of termination. Isn't this whole case about that paragraph, really?
Certainly could be. That's the way it appears.
And if that paragraph applies, the Magna law offices will be paid something. At least
by his client who accepted the settlement and the settlement check.
Of a third of the $15,000-something dollars. Is that right?
If that paragraph applies, that's the way I interpret it.
And so is the issue whether that particular paragraph applies?
Well, the trial court alluded to it, and it was addressed in our briefs that there has not been word from Mr. Betts or apparent cooperation from him, which could be deemed that the attorney-client relationship had been terminated.
Didn't Judge White find a constructive termination?
I don't know if that term was exactly used, but the court did allude to that. And
well, whether
whether
the phrase is used or not, there would have I don't see any way around some kind of termination.
Well, the court used, yes, a breakdown in the attorney-client relationship between Attorney Magna and Betts, and that was in the trial court's decision.
All right.
I think I read, but then when I tried to find it again, I couldn't, that the Diamond Jim's attorney gave advice to Diamond Jim's representatives in the negotiations with Betts. Is that right?
Plaintiff indicates that in the briefs, but that is not supported in the record at all, based upon affidavits supplied by myself and Diamond Jim's.
So you had no were you Betts's were you Diamond Jim's counsel at the time of the Betts agreement?
I was, but as the record reflects, this was done behind the backs of both attorneys.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. So you were the counsel, and you have an affidavit in there that the negotiation and the terminology used in the agreement were not reviewed by you and approved by you.
Correct,
or
Your
disapproved
Honor.
By you.
That is in the record.
Okay, that's all I want to know. Because I did read it. Do you remember where that was? Okay. We'll find it. All right.
I know it's in there. I cannot find it in the record at this time.
Okay. We'll just search it on the computer with a find and can do that.
How do you respond to the approach taken by the Court of Appeals here, where the Court of Appeals said public policy is really important in regard to supporting fee-shifting statutes such as the ones at issue here, and therefore we're going to find the other way from that of your client? How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the appellate court ignored the public policy that favors settlements and encourages settlements and favors the rights of litigants to resolve disputes among themselves. I think that the public policy that the appellate court applied is the tail wagging the dog of allowing the attorney to control the litigation, and I don't think the case law supports that. As we've pointed out, if consent was needed, that could have been taken care of by the legislature, as it is in personal injury settlements at 757, where attorney consent is needed, or in such instances with court approval, such as in a workers' compensation setting, where 102.29 requires a settlement to be approved and validated by the court. Otherwise, it is deemed invalid. And neither of those things the legislature has addressed and easily could have over the course that statutes such as these fee-shifting statutes
well,
have existed.
Well, is there a balancing that's occurring here? Was the Court of Appeals balancing the rights of clients to settle their own cases as against the importance of fee-shifting statutes?
Well, I don't see that as a balancing. And certainly the purpose of fee-shifting is to encourage litigants to come forward and to deter wrongful conduct. And that purpose was not thwarted in this instance. As pointed out in several cases, including the Gorton case, the ownership of the fees and the claim belongs to the aggrieved party, and then you look to the retainer agreement for disposition of those fees. I think public policy is satisfied in that regard, and the appellate court just said, well, public policy, it needs attorney consent, which I think would thwart and strangle the ability of parties to resolve their claims and get these types of claims resolved, where apparently it's attorney, I don't want to say interference, but it's the that aspect, the attorney fee aspect, that oftentimes prevents settlement. So by saying that public policy indicates that the agreement was invalid, I don't see a balancing, and if there was a balancing, I think it was inappropriately
Counsel, your settlement, not yours, but Diamond Jim's settlement agreement doesn't say anything about attorney fees expressly.
No, but it says any and all claims and
yeah, it's very broad.
And courts have routinely indicated that settlement agreements that have language such as that resolve the entire dispute.
Then it says you will both agree that Betts agrees to dismissal of the case. Doesn't the judge, once it gets into court, have to agree that it should be dismissed?
And the trial court did.
So the trial court agreed to the dismissal. Was that before or after Mr. Megner said, I want my attorney fees?
That was after, because the trial court looked at the settlement agreement, said it settled everything, including fees. There was no indication to the contrary. Settlement of all claims and causes of action is all claims and causes of action.
Counsel, as a follow-up to Justice Crooks's question, in terms of policy, under 100.18 and 100.20, which is its companion statute, there's case law that's often referred to as when attorneys take these cases, they're serving as private attorney generals, attorneys general perhaps. And, of course, the use of that phrase means there is a strong public policy to enforce the provisions of 100.18. Sometimes, actually, the attorney general's office does that and brings claims under 100.18. But this is a lawsuit involving what would be considered under our case law a private attorney general action. What, if any, import is the jurisprudence that underscores this is as a private attorney general action, enforcing the laws of the state?
My red light has turned on. I assume you want me to answer your question. The purpose underlying a fee-shifting statute such as this, there is discussion in the case law about the private attorney general, so people can advance these types of claims, has been achieved. And that was encompassed in the settlement, that settlement fees were to be included in it. And as counsel even points out in their briefs, that this settlement was at least double the value of the case. So certainly within the settlement agreement was the contemplation that by paying almost double the value of the case that those fees were included. They were paid to Mr. Betts, and that is where Mr. Megna has to look to collect them, because my client cannot be bound by a contract entered into between Mr. Betts and his counsel.
Counsel, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel?
Good morning. I'm Susan Griskoviak. This is Timothy Aiken. We both represent the respondent, Mr. Betts. If defendants are allowed to settle attorney fees under fee-shifting claims without the participation of the attorney who's worked on the case without any payment, it will put an end to all fee-shifting statutes in Wisconsin. And that's not an exaggeration. I've devoted my practice exclusively to fee-shifting cases since 2000. My law partner, attorney Vince Megna, has done so for more than 20 years. If defendants can do what Diamond Jims did in this case and accomplish a settlement behind our backs that eliminates the defendant's duty to pay attorney's fees, it will impact every case that we have, every fee-shifting case that any attorney has.
Counsel, you indicate that you represent Mr. Betts. In fact, Mr. Betts, wouldn't you agree, is a nominal participant in this, if a participant at all, and that you are representing Attorney Megna and his offices, your offices, to collect fees?
Well, based on the underlying court decisions, yes, Mr. Betts is no longer a participant in the proceedings, but under the Court of Appeals determination, where we're back to square one, he's very much involved. And typically, because the claim for attorney
fees... He's very much involved. Didn't Attorney Magnus subpoena him to the hearing, the original motion hearing that was scheduled in front of Judge White, and then he did not appear at that?
Actually, the trial court refused to enforce the subpoenas and wouldn't allow testimony.
Well,
Mr. Betts did not respond to the subpoena as far as the record indicates.
There's nothing in the record, but our office wasn't.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that the standard to apply to whether a valid assignment of rights has occurred is whether the language contained therein is unambiguous, clear, and unequivocal?
That's actually an issue that Attorney Aiken is going to address.
What issues are you covering?
I'm covering the public policy behind fee shifting.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Now, the Court of Appeals held that you're back to square one. Does Mr. Betts know that? Does he want to go back to square one? Does your client want to go back to square one, or do you really only want to deal with the attorney fees?
Well, we were looking for relief in the trial court and Court of Appeals for the settlement agreement to stay in place and simply have the defendant held accountable for payment of the attorney's fees. However, under the Court of Appeals determination, they put us back to square one to essentially undo it because the agreement itself was void.
Okay. But your original position was not that the agreement is void. Your original position is, okay, the agreement is okay between the two signatories, but that Diamond Jim can't cut you out.
That's correct. And it was Diamond Jim's that actually looked to have the contract rescinded.
And you're not looking to your own client, Mr. Betts, even though you do have a provision in the retainer that you can look to him.
We can only look to Mr. Betts if we're terminated, and we have not been terminated by Mr. Betts.
And that's your interpretation of the one-third clause?
Correct.
And you don't think it was a constructive termination either?
There was not.
Why not?
Because our office continued to represent Mr. Betts. There were discussions between the defendant's representatives. Diamond Jim's representatives went to Mr. Betts' homes to try to negotiate the settlement, and we were contacted. I had initially contacted Attorney Drabot, and that was before this actual settlement contract was reached. They were trying to give him only $12,000 and then went back the next day and continued to pressure him and try to get him to accept And that's how this $15,000 settlement contract came.
Is there anything in the record to support your assertion that Mr. Betts was pressured to enter into this?
Again, we were not able to present any testimony in the trial court level, and our subpoenas were quashed, so we were not.
Yeah, the answer is no.
There's nothing in the record.
And even though Mr. Betts entered into a contract with the son of the owner of Diamond Gyms, in which he signed the contract stating that all claims are settled, as in between the parties, you think that Mr. Betts is still your client?
He is our client. Mr. Betts isn't responsible for payment of our attorney's fees. Diamond Gyms is.
Why aren't you? So the answer to my question is yes. You think Mr. Betts remains your client, even though he signed an agreement settling his claims against the defendant.
Because he settled his portion of the claim, not the attorney fee portion.
He settled his claims. So if he settled his claims, how does he remain your client?
At this point in the case, again, if we're back to square one, we would continue on with the litigation. The deal that was reached between Diamond Gyms and Mr. Betts would be undone, so we would still have a misrepresentation case to pursue on his behalf.
Let's say the case doesn't turn out your way. What would preclude or prohibit your office from seeking recovery of attorney's fees from Mr. Betts?
I think there are a number of things, and I do believe that our contract provides that Mr. Betts isn't responsible for payment of our attorney's fees under the fee-shifting provision. We agreed to have Diamond Gyms pay those fees.
What about the last several paragraphs of the contract? And this was a contract, was it not, that was prepared by your office and presented to Mr. Betts?
It was.
And so in the last several paragraphs, especially the second to last, well, there are provisions here, would you agree with me, that allow for either party to terminate the representation, but it is made clear that Mr. Betts remains liable for any unpaid attorney's fees.
There's a termination clause, yes, but again,
right,
there's been
that
no
either
termination.
Either party could terminate. However, upon termination, the party remains liable to Mr. Magnus's office for attorney's fees, yes?
Under a termination situation, we've never enforced that. We've never had a situation come up like that. We've never sued a client of ours, and quite frankly, it's bad public policy for us to have to sue a client because a defendant went behind our backs to try to resolve a claim.
Oh, certainly. I understand the general idea that attorneys, law firms, sue their clients as a last resort, and rarely, in my observation. But other than that, is there anything to preclude you from seeking attorney's fees from Mr. Betts if this case doesn't go your way today?
Again, there's been no termination, and I believe that given that, we looked to defendant for payment of our attorney's fees under the fee-shifting statute, that Mr. Betts is not liable.
If a termination is found, one more, and then I will conclude for now. If a termination is found, is there anything to, if this court, reviewing de novo, the legal conclusions of both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, determines that there was a constructive termination, would there be anything to preclude your office from going to Mr. Betts to seek compensation?
Under the termination clause, in theory, we could do so.
What?
Under the termination clause, in theory, we could try to recoup funds from him.
In theory?
One-third of the recovery.
Isn't the answer just, why in theory?
Again, we've never sued a client, and I don't believe that that would be the case here. This wouldn't be the first time.
But there's nothing to preclude you from doing so.
There would not be under those circumstances.
I'm sorry, what?
There would not be under those circumstances.
Right.
Justice Prosser.
My question is this. There have been many people who've had problems with the automobiles they purchased. They turned out to be lemons, or they thought they were lemons, and they came to you folks. And I suspect that they signed an agreement just like this one. Are you saying that once people sign an agreement like this, they cannot terminate the law firm?
No, they could certainly terminate the law firm.
Well, when, in your view, could they terminate?
I think it would depend on the factual circumstances, that if a client weren't happy with the representation, they're free to have other counsel.
Well, in this case, in some sense, they must have been unhappy because they negotiated an agreement. They signed it.
Again, it was a situation of Diamond Jim's initiating a settlement, and Mr. Betz's refund claim under misrepresentation was worth approximately $8,700, and Diamond Jim's continued to offer him more money until it was essentially too much for Mr. Betz to resist. And that's what would carry forward in any fee-shifting case. In a Lemon Law case where we are against Ford Motor Company, a much larger defendant, a client who has a $15,000 claim but has had litigation go on where attorney's fees are over $50,000, Ford could offer them another $5,000 or $10,000 on top of what they would get at trial just to make the case go away. And this would be the norm in every case. It would allow defendants to circumvent the fee shifting and go directly to the consumer.
Isn't there a certain conflict of interest between what you're doing in the representation of Mr. Betz? Because he's got $15,000 at hand. He owes you some money under that clause. But what you seem to be arguing here is that he's got to give that money back and maybe take back an automobile he doesn't want, and then the litigation goes forward.
Well, that wasn't what we were requesting. Diamond Jim's requested rescission of the settlement contract between the parties. What we sought was for Mr. Betz to be treated as a prevailing party under the statute, which triggered the fee-shifting provision, and have the defendant pay our attorney's fees pursuant to that fee-shifting provision.
And you don't seem to have a conflict now because you seem to be saying you're not going to sue Betz.
Absolutely.
If you have a claim, you know, you're waiving it.
Correct.
So you're free of that. Now you're defending him on the settlement. It seems to me you're defending him on the settlement agreement. Okay, he wanted to settle, he settled. But he can't cut you out. That is, Diamond Jim can't cut you out. Now, Diamond Jim knew of your contract with Betz in July or earlier than the settlement agreement, right? I mean, that's in the affidavit.
Yes, and there was actually the litigation started in March of 2010. About 2 months later, we made a formal settlement offer to Diamond Jim's. Our attorney's fees were $5,900. It required that payment be made payable to our law firm, Aiken and Skopter, and separately accounted for Mr. Betz's damages. Mm-hmm. A few months thereafter, in September and November of 2010, Diamond Jim's made its own offers that accounted for payments to Mr. Betz, buying back the vehicle, essentially, and payments of attorney's fees independent of Mr. Betz's damages. So they were fully on notice and aware.
But did Mr. Betz get under the settlement agreement?
The settlement contract that he reached, $15,000.
Now, is what composed that $15,000?
I'm sorry?
How did you calculate? How did they calculate the $15,000?
I'm not aware of how they calculated it. I know that they started with
the damages.
His damages in the case were $8,700.
$8,700, and he put in some extra money for the new motor or the new used motor, okay, which brought it up to around $10,000.
Correct.
Can you account for the other $5,000 in damages?
I cannot. In terms of what Diamond Jim's paid.
And your attorney fees, at least at the earliest stage, was $5,900.
Okay. Yes, correct.
All right. I'll tell you, when I looked at this case and I looked at the retainer fee, I said to myself, you know, Diamond Jim's is aware of this retainer fee, retainer agreement that you have with Betz, and understands the statute, which is referred to in your retainer fee, understands the public policy behind the statute. Auto dealers don't like this statute, right? Because it says you got the lemon out there and they can show it and then they can prove it in court, you're going to pay. And the whole thing is set so that the onus is put on the dealer to make good on this auto. The auto next to the house is the most significant financial purchase most people ever make. Right?
Yes.
That's what the statistics show. And so to force a consumer to hire counsel, pay counsel, and fight about the lemon is not feasible. Because even if the consumer wins, a large part of that win is attorney fees. And so the statute is designed to make it really tough on the dealer, right?
Absolutely.
This is not an easy one. So I looked at this and I said, you know, implicit in this this employment contract is the concept that Betts knows, and anyone who deals with Betts that knows this contract, knows that you are relying on Diamond Jim for attorney fees.
Yes,
and that Betts, anyone who deals with Betts and undermines that, is in a position of interfering with the contract. And that implicit in this contract is an obligation on Betts not to do anything that undermines the contract.
That's true, and that would apply to third parties as well.
Pardon me?
It would apply to Betts as well as third parties such as
that's right, everyone. That the one of the obligations under the contract is not to interfere with the attorney rights that are provided and protected under statute. Although the case law says the claim for attorney fees belongs to the client, not the lawyer, right?
Yes, and the fee agreement controls ownership, and I see the red light is on.
Yes. And do you think there was an assignment here? You don't argue that as I read your brief.
It really wasn't raised, but yes, we do believe that there was a valid assignment. Absolutely.
Under the in terms of this, whether it's implicit or, as I set forth, or explicit.
Yes, correct.
Thank you. Mr. Aiken.
Good morning. Let me address the questions about this assignment. Obviously, if this document contract was drafted by a transactional lawyer, this could be clearer on assignment. However, long before the concept of contractual assignment came about, this court, way back in Patitucci versus Gerhardt and numerous cases since, has recognized the concept of either equitable subrogation or equitable indemnity, which is the concept by which if a person does work or makes a payment on behalf of another, they become subrogated to the rights of that other. So regardless if this language is as clear as it should be, and unfortunately these retainer agreements are created through experience of years of problems. And obviously, Mr. Magna hasn't had this problem, because if he had, this contract could have been better drafted. But it doesn't change the fact that he worked on this case, and everybody's emphasized his fees, but he's also incurred out-of-pocket costs in order to pursue this matter. When Diamond Jim says, well, the statute was fulfilled, Betts started his claim, Betts didn't start this claim, Magna did. And Magnus may be one of three lawyers in the state that takes these cases. They're fee-shifting, contingent cases, contingent hourly. You study your TV, you won't see one ad for contingent hourly cases by fee-shifting lawyers. These are tough cases, and if a defendant, once they realize they're going to pay, which is what happened here, that they can go out and induce this person to breach the contract. Now, if we're going to say that's an implied or constructive termination, well, a termination isn't if I pay someone $15,000 to terminate their lawyer. Is that really a termination? That isn't what this contract means. It means when, if you terminate me for without cause, the case law is clear. If it was for cause, this paragraph would probably be unenforceable. So this whole business of assignment, I think, is controlled by principles of equity and controlled by the fee-shifting statutes. And, I hope that my friend Mr. Magna will redraft his contract, but frankly, he's dealing with consumers who are already, as one of the justices pointed out, they have an $8,700 car, and they want some justice, But their big concern is, I can't go further in debt. I can't pay more. And, you know, $8,700. Now, in this case, at the time of this settlement, the fees were about $16,000, and that is in the record, at the trial court level anyway. So already the damages are still well within the what will become in the future the triple rule. They're only double. So the fees are not outrageous in this case, but they're still double what Mr. Betts, if he had to pay them himself, he'd be paying double the value of his car, and he wouldn't be getting any money yet. So I submit that the court ought to look to its decisions on subrogation, and there was a recent case on equitable indemnity that it's all the same point. There's even subrogation principles was applied to a mortgagee on a mortgage. There's many different applications, and as the court has said, subrogation is a concept that there's no black-letter rule for. So the insurance subrogation cases are helpful but not controlling. The mortgagee subrogation cases are helpful but not controlling.
Tell me how that works. You'll have to spell it out. I don't get it.
Okay. If someone, and most of the cases are paying something, so if someone pays a debt for another, now in the insurance situation, the insurance company's actually been paid to pay that debt.
Put it in this situation. Diamond Jim pays off bets. Who subrogated to what?
Mr. Magna is the claim for fees. He subrogated to the claim for fees, not dealing with their settlement contract, and not, but specifically growing out of his agreement to perform services under a fee-shifting statute, in which his fees are contingent on outcome and contingent on payment. So that in that situation, he is working essentially for free. He's advancing monies for free in order that if he wins under the contract, he seeks fees from Diamond Gems. That makes him a subrogated party.
So your argument is Magna is subrogated to Betts' claim for fees. So if Betts gets paid, Magna is subrogated.
Yes, and...
So from whom does Magna get fees?
Well, typically, when a party tries to rule out a subrogated party, that party is, both parties are essentially responsible is the answer to the court's question.
So your argument is that Magna is subrogated to Betts' claim for fees, recognizing Betts has the claim for fees. Magna is subrogated, and therefore Magna has a claim for fees
against
from both
Betts and Diamond Jim.
Both Betts and Diamond Jim. And if you don't want to collect from Betts, that doesn't mean you can't collect from Diamond Jim. That's your argument.
That is our argument precisely.
Get to the same point I made under an
It's identical. And you know one of the principles of subrogation that causes to come about is that the true wrongdoer pays. Who's the wrongdoer here? Diamond Jim's, by making almost a double payment on this case, admitted it was a wrongdoer under the case that Mr. Magna brought against Diamond Jim's. So,
well, it says in its settlement agreement it admits no wrong.
Right.
It always pays up without admitting wrong.
It always says that. But the fact is they paid almost double or at least a third, if we include that other $1,000 in the transaction, more than they had to pay. And under the case law that says who is the winning party or prevailing party, clearly, as the trial court found, clearly the Magna Bet side of the claim was the prevailing party. So then the question becomes, I think, for the court is if we don't recognize that the claim against Diamond Jim's continues for fee shifting, it's not like they were unaware of it. They made an offer that specifically attributed monies to Betts, monies to Magna. And Magna had made a similar offer, monies to Betts, monies to Magna. So they knew about the fee shifting. They knew that there was fees being incurred. They knew that Magna was looking to them for fees.
Is there anything in the record to indicate they knew the specific terms of the contract between Betts and Magna?
No, but if equitable subrogation or equitable indemnity controls, it doesn't matter because then it's the rules of equity.
I understand your argument about equity, counsel, but what you just said was that you are inferring, or your client is inferring, from these separate offers in regard to so much for Betts and so much for Magna, that I believe it was in response to questioning from the Chief Justice that your co-counsel indicated that Diamond Jim's knew the terms of the agreement between Betts and Magna. I am hearing from you that there is an inference that Diamond Jim's knew of the terms.
I think if it should be said knew or should have known. There's other facts.
Knew or should have known. In other words, you're asking us to infer that they knew.
I don't think that I'm asking that much, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I think that when you have parties making offers back and forth that separate the sums, I think when the defendant pays double the damages, I think when the defendant says that the settlement is confidential and there's not one word in the settlement about confidential.
I notice you pointed that out on page 4 of your brief, that there was no use of the word confidential in the agreement reached between Betts and Diamond Jim's. However, I also notice there's no use of the word assignment in the contract that was entered into between Betts and Magna.
You're right. That's why I'm pointing out equitable subrogation.
It seems to me that you expect, okay. So you expect the use of the word confidential to be used in the contract between Betts and Diamond Jim's, but when it comes to an assignment, notions of equitable estoppel are enough.
There was not only no terms of confidential, there was no proof put forward that this agreement was ever meant to be confidential. How can
agreement are we talking about?
The agreement between Betts and Diamond Jim's.
Sure, and that's really a sideshow here. Judge White took care of that by releasing the document to all parties in the in-camera or in the in-chambers conference. I just note that you expected a certain clarity from those parties without a reciprocal obligation on the part of your client.
Well, to be clear, though, because the subpoenas were quashed, we don't know if Betts thought he was releasing his attorney's attorney fee claim. We don't know that at this point in time.
Well, I mean, again, it seems a little ironic that you are asking us, you're saying it's not an inference that because separate dollar amounts were attributed to the party and to the lawyer, that therefore Diamond Jim's knew the specific terms of the agreement between Betts and your client. And now you are saying that clearly, it seems to me you're asking us to make a much greater leap.
Well, I think that what I'm trying to say is that if Betts wants to settle this case, I mean, if Diamond Jim's wants to settle this case with Betts alone and not include Magna, it would be their obligation to find out if Magna has a basis for his demands of fees and, in fact, their offers.
Didn't the settlement agreement include the phrase that this settles all of the claims between the parties? So part of, according to your theory, your client's theory, part of his claims would have included his lawyer's fees under the fee-shifting statute.
Not if he understood this contract the way we do. He wasn't responsible for fees under fee-shifting.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. The second-to-last paragraph of the contract that your client entered into with Mr. Betts, I found this to be a very interesting provision. Headline, bold, termination, paragraph. I understand that my attorney has the right to terminate me as a client. The law offices of Vince Magna will be entitled to fees for the work done at its hourly rate and its cost not to exceed one-third of my gross recovery. A couple of things struck me. The use of the word right, which implies that no showing of good cause is required. If an individual has a right to do something, they do not have to demonstrate any kind of good showing of good cause or reason, or even a reasonable purpose for what they're doing. This is an unfettered, to me, it seems like it was intended to be an unfettered right for Mr. Magna to terminate his client. Why does that not render this contract illusory?
Mr. Betts had the same right in the next paragraph.
With one difference. Mr. Betts is still on the hook for attorney's fees.
He's on the hook for attorney fees not to exceed one-third of the gross recovery. If the gross recovery is zero, he's not on the hook for any fees. If the recovery is a dollar, he's on the hook for 33 cents. That's not illusory.
It's not illusory for one party to have the authority to terminate the client and still have the provision that the client pay the hourly fees, which, what, $600 an hour, I think the record shows?
No, it's not to exceed one-third of the recovery. So if the recovery is zero, there are no fees owed.
Right. So it's, what was it, $600 an hour, not to exceed a third, or was it $355 an hour? I don't remember which was Mr. Magna's, and I don't remember which was yours.
Yeah, and I didn't work on this case before the appeal, so it would be Magna's and...
So that's $600 an hour, I think.
Me, not Magna.
You...
But in any event, if the recovery is zero, it's nothing.
Thanks.
So it's not illusory.
Mr. Aiken.
Yes.
I think you used the figure of $16,000 of accumulated fees for Mr. Magna. Is that right?
Yes, at the time of the settlement.
How much would Mr. Betts have had to recover? Really cover those attorney fees?
Well, if he recovers if he's the prevailing party, he recovers those fees from Diamond Jim's, and they're separate and apart from his compensatory recovery. So he doesn't have to recover anything from Diamond Jim's on his compensatory or punitive damage claim. That comes out of the fee shifting.
Okay, so that Mr. Betts could maybe collect $10,000?
Yes.
Mr. Magna could collect $16,000?
Sure. And oftentimes there's more disparate than that. That's why I referenced the new legislation that says we get three times the compensatories, but we're well within that realm. We're, at least in theory, we're either a third more than compensatories or at most double compensatories. So our $16,000 isn't even challengeable yet as far as exceeding that statute, which I don't know if it controls this situation or not, but if it did, we'd be well within the statutory guidelines. And I'd like to point out that the cases that hold... Oh, sorry, red light.
You may finish, but...
Okay. We need to keep in mind that the legislature has passed laws now about these fee-shifting agreements in the last year or two, which means the prior case law relied upon by the Court of Appeals in Cook, for example, is impliedly accepted by the legislature. And the legislature has never provided that these fee-shifting statutes should be less than they are. Thank you very much.
The whole point, though, which I'm surprised you didn't come back to, is that the public policy for this statute is that the fees will run more than recovery, which is why you have a statute that puts the onus on the dealer to pay up or will be penalized by paying attorney fees. Because unless you had that statute, he wouldn't sue, because you can't sue for $10,000, which is now a small claims case, I think. You can't sue for $10,000 and have a lawyer and come out whole or anywhere close to it.
I'll answer the question this way. We've had cases involving TVs and air conditioners that have been fraudulently sold. You definitely couldn't sue on those either. There's many claims that are covered by these fee shifting meant to help consumers against wrongdoers.
Even though one of these big new TVs can cost you $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 or even more. But if it's defective, you cannot sue and have a lawyer, because the fee will cost you more than you're better off buying another TV.
Absolutely true.
That's why you have this statute.
Absolutely true. Thank you very much.
Mr. Draper.
I believe I have 4 points to make. First point is regarding the knowledge of the retainer agreement, and the record will bear this out. Diamond Jim's had no knowledge of the retainer agreement until after the settlement was reached.
That's what your affidavit, which is on some page or other.
And I did find
says. It's on page 104, 109 of your appendix, and it's also up here elsewhere. It's on. It's on page.
Is that a question?
It's on page 224. In the course of my representation on July 26, 2011, I obtained a copy of the retainer agreement, right? That's after the settlement.
After the settlement.
But counsel,
you were new about Mr. Magna being counsel way before then because his name was all over the original complaint, right?
Well, certainly knew that we knew that Mr. Magna was involved, but did not know, were not privy to, and not a party to his retainer agreement.
But you did know that under a claim of 100.18 that actual attorney's fees were being sought.
Well, we knew that reasonable attorney's fees were being sought.
Well, let's take a look at the complaint. I mean, when you say reasonable actual attorney's fees. I mean, you can actual attorney's fees still are subject to reasonableness. So with that... But you knew that actual attorney's fees were being sought, I assume. Did you ever look at 100.18?
Yes.
And that entitles the attorney to actual attorney's fees, subject to the rule of reasonableness, as always?
Well, what it says is shall recover for such pecuniary loss together with costs, including reasonable attorney's fees, does not say actual.
That's 118.
100.18, correct.
Mm-hmm. Is my understanding of the case law interpreting that and the procedures, I think it's the Kalapar case that's oftentimes referred to, is that you put in the actual attorney's fees, submit the actual attorney's fees, then the court has considerations to make concerning the difficulty of the case. There's about six or seven considerations that the court makes, and then ultimately has to make a determination of reasonableness.
That can occur, but in this case it did not, as the court determined that the entire controversy had been resolved by the parties.
Is it your position that you had, prior to the settlement here, you had no idea that under 100.18 actual attorney's fees would be requested? Is that your position?
Well, I imagine that, as the statute said, they could request reasonable attorney's fees. But I direct the court's attention back to who owns that right. And it's very clear that the right, the cause of action is owned by the claimant, that is not owned by the attorney. And Mr. Betts resolved the entire claim, including attorney's fees. And the plaintiffs recognized that their client owned the fees because Mr. Aiken has referred to these settlement offers that had been extended. And one of the offers of settlement, and it's in the record at 116, says defendant Diamond Jim pays to the plaintiff, Randy Betts, the sum of $5,900 in attorney's fees. Now, it says make it payable to Aiken, but it doesn't say pay Aiken's fees. It says Diamond Jim will pay the plaintiff the sum of $5,900 in attorney's fees, which implicitly recognizes that the right for these fees belongs under the cause of action to the claimant, not to the attorney.
Which is an entirely separate question of whether your client knew the contents of the contract between Betts and Magna.
That's totally separate, and the record reflects that we did not. That was not disclosed until, as the court indicated, the court directed that the settlement agreement be turned over and that the retainer agreement be
turned
over.
So you can infer all sorts of things from the use or the reference of 100.18, but your client would have had, there's nothing in the record anyway to indicate that your client would have had any way of knowing about the other provisions allowing for either party to terminate the contract at will on pain of certain payments.
Correct. The red light is on. I have other points to make, but thank you very much.
I have a question for you. My understanding is that the rules of professional conduct require counsel to have a written agreement on fees. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So you know Betts has an attorney, right? Because the file, it's been filed, the attorney's name is on file, right?
Correct.
In fact, you've gotten communication from this attorney.
Yes.
You know that this attorney has to have a written agreement about fees with the client.
Correct. Right? I assume there's a retainer agreement.
That's right. You have to assume that. You also know there's a statute that says that you'd have to pay, your client would have to pay attorney fees, reasonable attorney fees, right?
If a,
you know,
if there's
a
recovery,
statute,
if there's a
right?
wrong in the statute, right. fees could be recovered.
You are therefore on notice, because that there's a retainer agreement, that that retainer agreement may say something about the rights of the attorney with the client debts, about how attorney fees are going to be paid and what their respective rights are and assignment of rights are under 118. You know that. You know that it could be in that agreement.
I did not know or assume what could be in that agreement.
You know there's an agreement. You know there are attorney fees. The reasonable inference is it might have something and that, therefore, there's a claim here by the attorney. That's what the argument is.
That's okay? what the argument
is. That's what the argument is. And despite that inference from these facts, you settle out for all claims. Frankly, probably if I were the advising the client, which you say you didn't advise the client, that would be a good deal, because what's the most that could happen? You're going to have to pay up what you would have had to pay up anyway. This way you stand a fighting chance. But there is here some several layers of facts that you do know that raise may be viewed as raising reasonable inferences. And you don't think they do raise reasonable inferences.
Well, I, as the attorney, might know that there's a retainer agreement, but the parties, as they settled this claim by themselves without involvement of
they're
counsel,
assumed, everybody's assumed to know the law. Of course, that's nutty, but that's the assumption, right?
Right.
Everybody is assumed to know all the law, right?
Hopefully you don't assume I know it all.
I don't know all the law. Why should you know all the law? But the law treats everybody as knowing everything.
Law might be a little different from the contract, though, too.
Okay.
Counsel.
Go ahead, Justice Brasso.
Your opposing counsel, I think, referred twice to you advocating rescission of something. Would you speak to that?
I'm sorry, again?
Your opposing counsel said that you had advocated, I think, before the circuit court, the rescission of a contract. What is that about?
In the trial court, we advanced several arguments, and our primary argument that this was a valid binding contract that resolved all claims and should dismiss all claims. We argued some alternate theories, such as rescission or reformation of the contract, and the court did not address those, as it determined that this was a full settlement by the client, by the parties who owned Mr. Betts, who owned the right. So although there was discussion in some of the briefs about rescission or reformation, the trial court and the appellate court did not address those.
You were talking about rescission of the settlement agreement? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, because we would have no authority to
end. That's right. So what you one of the arguments you made at the trial court was, okay, Betts, okay, Magna, if you're not happy with this settlement agreement and you want more, let's rescind the settlement agreement. You give us back the $15,000 and start again. Isn't that right?
If there was not a meeting of the minds.
If the settlement agreement wasn't complete and the good, let's start again, right?
That
and that's, in effect, what the Court of Appeals did.
The Court of Appeals did that, but our primary argument, as the trial court indicated, was that this is a valid settlement that resolved everything.
That's the rescission being talked about. Rescind the 15 grand payment.
If you had your way, though, you would have this court affirm that settlement agreement, wouldn't you?
We had asked the court to affirm the trial court's decision.
Any other questions? If not, I want to thank you, Mr. Draven.
Thank you very much.
And counsel from Aiken and Sculptor for their arguments in this Lemon Law case. We've had several Lemon Law cases, and the arguments go further than Lemon Law, but involve any dealing related to 100.18 and misrepresentation, which are very interesting in the law and ever-changing with the new legislation. That completes our hearing in 2012 AP 183, Randy L. Betts versus Diamond Jim's Auto Sales. We will take a brief recess so that these students may leave and a second group of the Hamilton High School students may come in for the second argument. We are in recess.